Good morning, again. I'm gonna move over. It's good to be with you. So Jay is away, and I'm here. I knew this was coming. Maybe I should have prepared better. Jay and I talked about the possibility that I would fill in for him, and this was a couple months ago before we had left Rwanda for our visit here. I must have been nervous because I had this dream, and I was actually standing right here. I had gotten up after the music to read the collect, and I looked out, and we were in the church, but the church was like a meadow, and the center aisle was more like a country lane. And you were all sitting in park benches. And it was really quite lovely. And I looked down to read the collect, and my bulletin was full of maps. And I was flipping through frantically, like, where did it go? And finally, I turned to Amanda, can you show me? It's good to be with family when you feel nervous. It's hard these days, I think, to be ordinary, to be average. I don't know about you, but I tend to feel pretty average a lot of the time. I'm going to try, just for a moment, to dispel what I think are rumors about missionaries, and that is that we are some extraordinary types who live and lead adventurous lives. It's actually not true. Our day in and our day out is very typical. It's mundane. We get up in the morning, we fix a breakfast, we try to manage our son. We drive to work, we sit in an office or my wife teaches in a classroom. We come home at night, we feel tired, and we try to make something for dinner and go to bed. And I don't know if that sounds like your life, but it sounds pretty ordinary to me. It's hard, though, in our world today, to be ordinary. On the one hand, the world is saying, everyone is extraordinary. You can be whatever you want to be, just don't be ordinary, right? And then the church says, maybe not this church, but I think our Christian culture today is saying, God is only in it if it is extraordinary. Go on a mission trip. Get out of your comfort zone for the Lord. Take a risk for Jesus. And we may start to feel like our ordinary lives are somehow disconnected from what God is doing. And God really isn't with us in our day in and our day out. And ordinary people like us start to feel maybe a little out of place. I think the Genesis passage that was read for us invites us to inhabit a world in which God is deeply and intimately involved in ordinary things. And now, the idea of arranged marriage, and if you saw my Facebook this week, I'm not actually going to make a case for arranged marriages. But it was a typical thing in the ancient world to arrange a marriage for a son or a daughter. It was ordinary. And so the Genesis passage invites us to live as ordinary people, expecting an extraordinary God to show up in our daily lives. Now, the lectionary reading is a little bit deceptive. If you have Genesis 24 in front of you, you'll notice that it's actually quite a long chapter. The lectionary does a good job of highlighting the really essential parts, but obscures a few things. I just want to mention these as a way to introduce the chapter. The account of the search for Isaac's wife is one of the longest accounts in all of the book of Genesis. Now, biblical narratives, as you might know, are relatively succinct and concise, and there's a conservation of words. For example, the story that was read last week, the sacrifice of Isaac, was 19 verses. Pretty extraordinary event. But this chapter, is 67 verses. Not only is it long, but it's also very repetitive. In a long speech, the servant recounts everything that had happened up until his time with Rebecca's family. And the length and the repetition is all the more impressive given the ordinariness of the situation. Finding a wife for Isaac is sort of a commonplace event. And then, of course, there is this servant, this unknown, unnamed, not-to-appear-again person who is introduced right into the story of Abraham and his family and his descendants, but we don't know anything about him. All this seems to suggest to me that at this midpoint of Genesis, we are meant to pause. It slows the pace of the narration. It focuses us in on what is happening, to take stock of what God is doing, to prepare us for what God is going to do in the rest of the story. Now, with that said, and before we get into the passage, there are a few things that I want to say that this passage is not about, just in case you were here, you read it beforehand, and you were hoping for something different. It might deal with some things to some extent, but it's not about them. This is not about how God will write your love story for you. I'm sorry. Or how we can know the person that we are supposed to marry. If you want to know, actually, you could talk to me, and I can point you in that direction. It's also not an argument for arranged marriages, though I will be arranging Josiah's marriage one day. It's not about how we should test God's will in prayer by setting up some sort of proof system for him to fit in and fulfill. And though I think it does encourage expectant prayer. Nor is this a model for servanthood, though the servant is a model for service. And I don't think this is about the tension between divine sovereignty and human responsibility, as some of you might like to think. But that's in there. Now, I think this passage is about God, a God who protects and provides for what he has promised, God who is faithful, even in ordinary things. And this note was sounded for us last week. Remember, on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. God provides the ram in the bushes to save Isaac's life. And God provides the sacrifice of his own son to save ours. God provides. Again, this morning, in these ordinary circumstances, we hear of God's provision. So let's look at Genesis 24. And let's read it as a narrative of God's faithfulness. The story begins by indicating that Abraham, in verse 1, is old and that God has blessed him. And this pushes us back, if we know the story well, to the time when God had said, "I will bless you and make you a great nation." So in a sense, we're coming to the end of Abraham's part in this story. God has blessed him. And when Abraham calls his servant in and gives him the commission, that makes him swear, he makes him swear by God, the Creator. And so it's not just some old blessing, some ordinary blessing from God, but it's a blessing that fits within God's work of creation and recreation. It reminds us that the Abraham story is part of God's bigger story to renew and remake his broken and fallen world. And so Abraham makes his senior servant swear by the Lord that he will get a wife for Isaac, and that this wife will come from his own relatives. For the promise of descendants to be fulfilled, Isaac will need a wife. The servant asks what is probably a logical question. What if she doesn't want to come? Maybe some of you have been there wondering, what if she says no? Should I then take Isaac back to where you came from? And with this, the question of the promise hangs in the balance. Land and descendants. This is what God had promised. I will make you a great nation. You will inherit this land. But what if she says no? What if God doesn't provide? Will God keep his promise? Or will the promise die with Abraham? But Abraham asserts that God will indeed provide. So the servant sets out, goes on his mission trip. But he goes with the assurance that the Lord is with him, that the Lord will provide. And you have to wonder on the way, and it's interesting that this journey part is very condensed. It's the speeches that get all the space. But you wonder what went through his mind on the trip. Did he doubt? Did he think, well, you know, Abraham's getting pretty old. Maybe he's not seeing things so clearly anymore. Maybe he doesn't know how the kids are thinking these days. Might be harder to get her to come back. Did he think back to how God had been faithful in Abraham's life already? Maybe he was one of the servants who went with Abraham and Isaac to that mountain without a lamb to sacrifice, but wood for a sacrifice to be burnt. Maybe he remembers how they came down and how everything changed. Whatever it is, his prayer, when he reaches the well, is a prayer full of faith, full of trust that the Lord can and will provide. And though it's sort of a strange prayer to us because it seems to suggest that somehow he's testing God or asking for a proof from God, it's really framed by the belief in the covenant promises of the Lord. He's asking no less than that God will show his kindness to Abraham, that God will prove his faithfulness, that God will be who God has said that he will be by providing a wife for Isaac. And even before he finishes praying, who knows what he might have continued to pray, but here comes Rebecca to the well. And all the servant had prayed for, the water and the camels and the well, and that everyone would be relieved of their thirst, it all comes together. It's all fulfilled. And then there's even more. That she even says, come and stay with us. We have room for you and for your camels. And it's obvious that the Lord has done it. And realizing this, the servant bows and worships the Lord. Praise be to the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his kindness and faithfulness to my master. As for me, the Lord has led me on the journey to the house of my master's relatives. It's the Lord. The Lord has done it. The Lord has been faithful. You can see it. And Laban, Rebecca's brother, who will figure prominently later in Genesis, not necessarily as the most positive character, he comes out and welcomes the servant and his men and the camels into the house and sits him down to a meal. But before he can eat, he has to relay all that has happened. And from verses 34 to 49, this long speech, he recounts, and this is where it becomes repetitive, he recounts everything that has happened already and more, because he even says what our narrative had begun with, that the Lord has blessed Abraham. And then he tells of his commission and Abraham's confidence in the Lord who would provide, and the interaction with Rebekah at the well, and even his own praise. He tells him how he worshiped God. And after the story has been fully recounted, the servant puts the question to Rebekah's family, will you show kindness and faithfulness to my master? In essence, it's obvious what God has done. Just listen to my story. Will you do likewise? Either do as the Lord or don't. It's interesting. It's almost like he invites him to participate in what God is doing. The servant has given witness, and Laban responds. He says, this is from the Lord. We can say nothing to you one way or the other. Here is Rebekah, take her and go, and let her become the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has directed. Every person in this narrative recognizes that God is in it, that God is providing. And as we near the end, climax sort of builds in the narrative, and Rebekah's brother and mother tried to delay the servant and Rebekah from leaving, from going back to Canaan. And so they ask her, will you go with this man? And this provides the climactic answer to the question that we started with. What if she says no? And very succinctly, very directly, she says, I will go. And she echoes, in a sense, Abraham's own response to God's call to leave. She becomes, in a way, a new Abraham as the story unfolds. With that, her family blesses her in words that echo God's words to Abraham when he left home. Our sister, may you increase to thousands upon thousands. May your offspring possess the cities of their enemies. And it even echoes what God says in the Garden of Eden, I think. It answers a question for us, at least points toward an answer that, yes, the seed of the woman who will crush the head of the serpent will come from Abraham, will come from his descendants, will possess the cities of their enemies. And if you needed some romance this morning, I think the conclusion is maybe where we can draw some of that up. If you channel a little Jane Austen and imagine the scene with Keira Knightley as Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy walking through the field, and cue the wind and the sun shining from the back. Rebecca says, who's that? And the servant says, that's my master. She covers her face and the veil blows in the wind. And from beginning to end, this is a story of God at work, God's faithfulness. And I think we're meant, and I think the people of God who have read this story at all times and in all places are meant to get to this point after seeing all that God has done and say, what might God do in our lives? And such an ordinary thing like finding a wife for his master's son, what might God also do here in my workplace or at home or at school or when I'm at Starbucks or when I'm in my car on the way to work? How is God going to intervene and be involved in those places? The thing that strikes me about this and the thing that I've been pondering over this week is that in the midst of all that God accomplishes and all that God does here, there's Abraham's servant, unknown, unnamed. In his mundane occupation of finding a wife for Isaac, he's swept up into God's great redemptive plan. He's swept up into something that's so much bigger than himself. And in some ways, I feel like that. Actually, I feel like that's our story as a church. I don't know all of you. I'm getting to know some of you. But my wife and I were sent out from here. And you know, these days it's not common for churches, a church body, to send out missionaries. It doesn't happen a lot. But you know what I think is happening? I think what God is doing is that he's welcoming us into a participation in something bigger than all of us, something bigger than this right here in Highland Park. We are becoming, together, a picture of the universal church with our brothers and sisters in Rwanda, black and white, African, American, mixing together, even at a distance. This is what God is doing. He's making a people for himself. He's creating a people for himself to worship him And we are participating in that together. And so, thank you. Thanks for sending us. Thanks for supporting us and praying for us. I want to say that it's not just my wife and I and Josiah who are on mission. We are all on mission in the ordinary places and times of our lives. I think it's in those times that we are most on mission, actually. In our work, in our home, at school. And we should be ready to see God at work. Just like the servant expected God to be involved, to show up, and to be faithful. And I think just like the servant invites Laban and the family to be involved and participate in what God was doing, that's part of our call to our neighbors and our friends. Come be part of what God is doing here. Come and experience God in the ordinary things of life. Because going back to what I said before, I think a lot of people feel ordinary. I think maybe in our best moments, we feel ordinary, and maybe in our worst moments, we feel a lot less. And that's probably true of most of our friends and neighbors. And wouldn't it be great to tell them that, well, actually, in those times and in those places, God will meet you. He'll be faithful. He'll provide. He'll protect. And that he's carrying out his plan and his promise. I just want to close with a thought. We are in the season of ordinary time. And I've been using the word ordinary partly to connect to the place we are in the church calendar. And I think ordinary time, as it sort of slows us down and actually becomes sort of mundane, and church kind of gets a little boring and routine, and green sort of gets worn out on us, and we wonder how many green shirts Charles can possibly have. He's not here. I think ordinary time is a great time to look for God's hand and listen for God's voice in the ordinary places and times of our lives. To ask God, Lord, what are you doing in my day in and day out? At home and at work, at school. So that we might be his people. Let's expect the Lord to do extraordinary things in our daily lives. And let's invite others to be a part of it. Thanks be to God.